Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach. And if today is Saturday, October 4th, you're welcome to call in with your thoughts, comments. We do not have Lynn Willey with us in this hour. So 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County is the telephone number. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400.
Anywhere else within the sound of his voice.
Or your voice. Our voices collectively.
Collective voices.
Our collective voices. We collect voices.
Right. That's good. Okay. And you're welcome to give us a call. We had an exciting conversation, which was historically significant in that we realized that Lynn Willey was shocked to discover
that we agree on
things. Almost all major points, which will just, I'm sure.
I think it is a shock every time we sit down with Lynn and we actually talk together that we agree with him. And it's one of those strange facets of life.
Or does he agree with us?
I could be that, yeah. Which, are you my dad or am I your son?
Yes.
Yes.
That's the confusing thing. So you're welcome to give us a call. We, for those of you who didn't notice, and I realize that if you're outside of the fiscal realm, you may not have noticed that the second quarter, or the third quarter,
third
actually,
quarter.
The third quarter of the calendar year ended last week, or this week, actually.
On the 1st.
Well, actually, it ended.
Midnight on the 1st.
It was just
also
before the 1st.
Midnight at the end of... It's very strange.
Yes.
Zero hour.
And the behavior during that quarter was sort of fascinating in the stock market. The old adage of sell in May and go away didn't work because
nope.
Had you sold in May, you would have missed about a 5.4% rise in the S&P 500. But in this last quarter, we had, let us simply say, restrained growth. Most asset classes were actually in negative territory.
We're talking about market here, not
yes.
not GDP. The GDP
and
had much less than restrained growth. It had huge growth.
We had a very typical seasonal third quarter in that it's atypical in that it didn't fall. Historically, we were due for a fall instead of
it's fall now.
But
we
actually got a slight decline, but nowhere near as badly as it could be. Although we still could get it this month. October is the bleed over.
It is. This is the normal month for when you talk about Black Friday or Black any other day. It's often referring to an October month. Not that that has anything to do with anything other than we tend to think in terms of conserving in the autumn because genetically that's when we do it. We bring in the harvest. Now, I have a subject to bring up. Do you want to finish
this? Let me just finish this thing out for the quarter. I just wanted to because if you get quarterly statements or whatever and you're down a bit for the quarter, don't worry about it. You could have been down a lot more and in many ways should have been down a lot more. And a lot of it had to do with about $13 billion was liquidated from domestic equity mutual funds in this last quarter, which doesn't make a lot of sense, and went to money market funds. The international funds went down about 4 or 5%, generally speaking, and there's a very good reason for that. Europe is teetering on the edge of, or maybe is, back in recession. Small company funds got beat up after a great run over several years. And that's an interesting, the reason I want to bring all this up is because this is sort of the pause that refreshes. Even utility funds were down about 5%, real estate funds down about 3% on average. Natural resources funds fell about 10%. Precious metals plummeted 20%. Gold prices fell about 8%, silver 19%. I know this all sounds very, very depressing. What I'm trying to say here, though, is many of the asset classes out there that people think of as stable, for instance, gold or silver, fell in the quarter very significantly enough that it would be considered correction-level collapses, whereas stocks... pretty much domestic U.S. stocks in the mid-cap area, in the large-cap area, held their own. But the good news is, and this is a point I wanted to make, when we look at the one-year return right now on markets in the United States and asset allocations that we put together, what you've seen over the past 12 months, and that's the minimum time you should look at, is about an average long-term return. In other words, if we look at the 12-month period, this last 12 months is significant. In when you get your statements, go back and look a year earlier and take a look at that, because this is an unusual time that you can see in 1 year kind of a snapshot of what goes on over a 30-year period. Good times and bad times coming together and producing, for instance, in the equity markets, about a 12% rate of return. Now, obviously, you're not all invested in one equity market or something, so you probably didn't get a 12% rate of return. But what I want you to do is take a look at that, because this is pretty much what you could reasonably expect over decades, but you saw it in 1 year. So there's your measure. If you look at your total portfolio over the last 12 months, whatever allocation you have, whether or not you even realize you have an allocation, you probably, whatever number you see on there, is actually pretty close to the likely long-term return of your portfolio. And that gives you one of those rare opportunities to glimpse an underlying financial and fiscal reality in your investment portfolio. If you got an exceptionally high return over the last 12 months, you're in for a fall someplace. If you got an exceptionally low return, you probably, if it was too low over the last 12 months for your comfort zone, you might want to relook at the way things are put together. And that was really what I wanted to say. Okay?
All right. Cool. Well, I want to talk about a security breach that's happened, or at least been announced, at J.P. Morgan.
Oh, yeah. That was a big one.
Right.
How many millions of people was it? 26?
76.
76 million
people.
76
information.
Million people had their information lost.
So I'm going to begin at the beginning.
That's a very good place to start.
And lest people think that this is worse than it is, I'm going to first say that no really sensitive data was lost. It was only the names, the addresses, and the email addresses of people that are customers of J.P. Morgan.
Or so we think. When Target came out, that's what they said, too.
Okay. So I'm going to begin at the beginning. J.P. Morgan has been one of the leaders in encryption technology in the business of transactions and so on. They have in the past been extremely good about keeping their data secure. However, about midway through last year, the person in charge of their encryption team was hired away by a place called First Data. First Data is an encryption service. They do payment processing for merchants, for credit cards, and for transactions on stock exchanges, all that good stuff. And he started hiring all of his former colleagues over at J.P. Morgan. So up till about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, he was hiring at a pretty rapid rate right out of the team of encryption specialists that were over at J.P. Morgan. The guy in charge of their IT is still the same guy over at J.P. Morgan. However, most of his team involved in the security side of things has been hired out from underneath him to go over to work at First Data. Now, J.P. Morgan just got paid a bunch of money at the beginning of this year in January by First Data, about $10 million, to settle the anti-compete clause in the contract where he was hiring people in a competitive way. All right, so come forward to July. In July, for about 2 weeks, some very organized group of hackers was wandering around J.P. Morgan's equipment. Now,
Wait a minute. They were not literally walking around their equipment.
No, they were figuratively walking around. They were walking around with their data. So let me begin this process
by
saying
their avatars were in the equipment.
Yeah, let me begin this process by saying that just like office space in a building, most companies do not own the server that they're in. Or if they do, they rent out the extra space that's not being used to the rest of the server farm. So most of those websites that you visit for banking or whatever else, those sites are being hosted at huge server farms by Amazon, by Microsoft, by Google, these huge farms. And those farms, they're really literally look like rows of crops, only they're big blinking machines. And you've seen pictures of them.
A blinking machine you got there a lot.
It's a temperature controlled room, and it's literally in a vault. These big steel doors with electronic and mechanical locks all over them. They have multiple power sources from different places so that if one fails, they pick right back up. But there's off-site backup locations that pick up. As soon as one goes down, another one will come right back up. And they do what's called load sharing. So it's being shared across both all of those at the same time. The concept of what happens here, and I'm going to lay out hopefully in an analogy that makes it understandable. If you consider yourself when you go to and from work to be sensitive information and you're being protected, whether by a bodyguard or whatever, and you live most of the time at your house in a safe room, it's a vault, okay? This is a weird analogy, but if you follow with me, you're lying in your bed in the vault, you get up, it's time to go to work, but you wait till your security guard, you can see him through the camera in your safe room. He's in your house, he's waiting at your vault door. You open the door, you step out, the security guard's there, you close the door, you lock it all up. Security guard takes you to your car, drives you in the car, he's completely controlling the situation, nice and secure. He gets to the office building, and imagine this is a big high-rise with lots of offices in it. And you go to your office, he escorts you all the way into your office, and he opens up your vault, you open the vault, and you step inside, they close the door, and then the security guard leaves. What I've just described in a typical security setting would be in-transit security and at-rest security. These are typical terms when you're thinking about tactical things. We use the same terms when we're talking about encryption. You've got at-rest security for your data, and you've got in-transit security for your data. The NSA, through Snowden's releases, we know that they basically record everything that goes on in transit. Anything that's moving on any of the roads is being recorded by the NSA. They set up little listening posts outside of Google, kind of on the property with Google, and outside of Facebook, kind of on the property with Facebook. And they're just recording everything. Now, they're not looking at the stuff, supposedly, unless they have a court order. Now, let's move on to J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan, using that same analogy, you're sitting at home and you're doing your banking stuff. So your banking information is going up to J.P. Morgan. It's got to go through J.P. Morgan's security system. And some of your information is not considered sensitive. It takes a long time to get in and out of that big vault. And when you're logging into a website, it's that time you want your data to pop up pretty quick. And if you have at-rest encryption, it's slower. It's just like opening that big vault. It takes a while. So they hold that data that isn't sensitive out in their normal lobby area. And what we've discovered, what J.P. Morgan discovered, is that, and they discovered this, this is great how they discovered it. They discovered that they were compromised because if we use the same analogy, say you were leaving some mail on the desk in the lobby, and over a period of days, you notice that the mail is moving around. It's not exactly where you left it. Maybe it was the cleaning team. Maybe there was like something going on. But after a while, you go, wait, this mail has been opened, and I didn't open it yet. That's how they figured out that somebody was there. Somebody has been wandering around in the outside offices, the non-encrypted area at J.P. Morgan. They're avatars. Someone has gotten into the server, and they're reading all this data, and they're trying to figure out how to get into the vault. Well, the J.P. Morgan security guys, they go, whoa, something weird's going on. So they start trying to track it. They get in touch with the FBI. The NSA gets involved. They start looking around. Who's going on? What's happening here? What we know about the intrusion, or about any intrusion, first, this is a highly organized group. It isn't one person. It is a large group because they are infiltrating a lot more than one server. They're basically looking at all the branches at JP Morgan. They're wandering around all those servers. Two, what we know, none of the chatter that exists, you know, people are familiar with the group Anonymous. Have you heard of them?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Anonymous, when
I don't know who they are.
No, no, because they're very anonymous.
Right.
As a group, they are pretty intelligent people, but they're not well organized. And they can't stop themselves from talking to each other about their accomplishments. So if they hack something, they tell each other pretty quickly, because that's why they're doing it. That's their motivation. They want to tell each other, hey, I'm a better hacker than you are. That's not happening. So there is a large organization that isn't chattering about what they're doing. And that leaves two organizations that it could possibly be that we know of. It's either the Russians or the Chinese.
Well, it could be like the Iranians.
It could be the Iranians. It's very unlikely. The Iranians are not this good.
They're just not that good, right?
Right. The Chinese are this good, but they don't hack banks. They look at Defense Department contracts. They're looking at stuff that they could build, technical stuff.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out how Intel builds their computers. They're trying to, you know, it's commercial espionage,
right,
not banking. The Russians are right in the middle of something where we've been locking off their banking. And they're making a statement here. And the fact that it took us 2 weeks to recognize at one of the most major banks that somebody was wandering around the lobby after hours and reading the mail is a problem. Now, none of that vaulted stuff was compromised.
That we know of.
That we know of. However, here's the big thing. The Russians are, their MO, when they're doing this sort of thing, they're really good at getting into the servers and wandering around and reading the mail. What they have now is a bunch of emails of people who they know bank at JP Morgan. So if you get an email from JP Morgan and you bank at JP Morgan or you invest through JP Morgan, don't follow any links.
Do not. And by following links, he means that when you see those little things on click here, don't.
If you want to log into JP Morgan's site, you go to JP Morgan's site. You don't get to it through your email, because this is how they would get to the really sensitive information.
This is why I say that we know of. It's the possibility exists at this point that if people have been clicking on,
right,
by the way, the news media release that JP Morgan compromised, I wouldn't be at all. Don't be too surprised if you get an email if you've done any business with J.P. Morgan and or something that says your information may have been compromised. Click here.
Right. Don't click there.
Because as soon as you do, presuming that, and I would not be surprised at this point to find that people have already done this.
Right.
Once you give them your password information, which they're going to ask for. Then let's assume that the Russians are doing this for a moment.
It's a good assumption. There's a high probability, right, that they have done this.
The Russians will have access to the J.P. Morgan vault, at least your portion of it.
Just your portion.
And once they get into your portion, it's a lot easier once you're into one of the boxes in the bank vault to get to the next box than it is to get into the bank vault.
Actually, that's not exactly the case. Every time they do it, but right now, they can't see the mass of data in there. They're only going to see it at the individual level. It is compartmentalized. It's like lots of little vaults.
Right. It's like safety deposit boxes, right, inside the vault.
But once they're in the vault, they can start to understand what the key is to get into the vault. And it gives them more tools. So JP Morgan's got a big task right now. It's a lot bigger a task than Target had. Target had some of its server compromised in the transit area. They didn't get into the vault, but they were recording the transactions.
Right.
So anyway, JP Morgan's going to have to replace a bunch of stuff, and they've got a lot of egg on their face. The fact that First Data hired away all the encryption team and then JP Morgan was hacked is a sign that there was some issue here. There are, you know, as much as I dislike over-regulation, there is no law in the national level that says that once you have been compromised, and it's not necessarily secure data that's been compromised. There's no law that says the amount of time you have to report it. So what we're talking about here is non-sensitive data, but data that allows from July to October, we're now in October, whoever got this data to communicate with the bank customers to begin the process of getting into their stuff, their access, their sensitive material.
And by the way, just because you haven't seen your bank account suddenly emptied out,
that doesn't mean they're not in there.
Right. If I could back this up to a strategic level.
Yeah.
One of the things that it's just Jeff McClure's humble opinion, although there's some others who share this. If we want to be concerned about something, it is Russia right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Vladimir Putin has an economy that is in, at the very least, a recession at this point.
It's probably more likely a depression.
And they're hurting, and they're hurting badly, and he has made statements that there will be a price that we will pay in the West
for the sanctions.
For the sanctions that we have put against them hurting their economy. He hasn't said what they were, but he suggested that his retaliation would be in the same areas where he was being hit,
which is banking. This is the other. Right. You've got an MO that fits Russia, and you've got a motive that fits Russia. This looks like Russia.
And Premier Putin has been stating again and again and again that his country is, now he hasn't used this term, effectively at war with the United States. And it basically he wishes to distract the Russian people from the economic malaise. Let's use the Jimmy Carter term, malaise that is settled across Russia, and they've got a bad one.
Yeah, and he's just
where young people are exiting the country. Money, by the way, is rushing out of the country anywhere it can get out of the country. And he is trying to distract them by saying we have an enemy. And the propaganda, he now controls the news media pretty thoroughly. The propaganda is that we are the evil ones and that literally there are fascists in fighting.
Got a piece here for you. Do you remember what the news organization, the broadcast news organization of the Soviet Union was?
Pravda.
No, that's the newspaper.
Oh, okay.
That's still the official newspaper. It's still called Pravda.
Which
that
means
name,
truth, by the way.
Right. It was never that name was never changed when it went to the Russian Republic.
The literal translation is proven.
Right. So there was an organization, and the translation's loose, but basically it was the Soviet Broadcast Company, basically like the British Broadcast Company or the Canadian Broadcast Company. And the Soviet Broadcast Company, when Yeltsin was in his presidency of the Republic rather than the Union, he changed it to the Russian Broadcast Company. Last week, the name was changed by Vladimir Putin back to the Soviet Broadcast Company.
Really?
What do you think that means?
He is trying to resurrect the nostalgia for the good old days of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and there are some things that are happening on the world stage if we look at it a little bit strategically. He's very confused right now, Putin is, by Obama.
He's not the only one.
He's not the only one. The reason why he's not acting more aggressively, which I know that sounds strange, he hasn't publicly to the West said that he was in Russia, though he is publicly...
In Russia?
In Ukraine.
Putin has not said he was in Russia.
He hasn't said he's in Ukraine. I'm sorry, I used the wrong country there.
He wasn't personally.
Right. He said to the West that no Russian troops are involved in Ukraine. However, there are a series of funerals that have been taking place over the past 2 weeks that he's attended of Russian troops that died in Ukraine.
No, they weren't there.
Oh, they were. And he says it in the funeral. He says that they were there, that they are great patriots, that they fought for Russia in Ukraine. But then immediately turns to the West and says, we have no troops in Ukraine.
Well, because they're dead.
Well, those
ones
they
brought them home and buried them.
Right. So so that's going on right now.
You have to understand Russian logic.
And if you look around the outskirts of Russia, when NATO and the European Union are making encroachments on the border of Russia, Russia steps in and destabilizes the country. doesn't really want the Civil War to win on either way. So he annexed Crimea, and he's supporting the rebels in Ukraine. If you go to South Ossetia, it's the same thing. Moldova. You go through all of these areas that he is inciting rebellion but supplying both sides. He's just making a buffer zone around himself. And then you look over at Syria, where he's got national interests there, and he's confused. And said he was confused about Obama. Obama is now, he's been on and off supporting the rebels in Syria, not with any intent to make them win, just to let them fight, because he doesn't want to make them win. Now he's got airstrikes going on because it looks like the rebels were having trouble with IS. So if
now, from who's Putin's, the he that you're referring
to? This is Obama.
Okay.
Now, if you look at Putin's perspective, Putin's looking over at Syria and saying, Obama's using exactly my methodology of destabilizing things that are causing me a little bit of paranoia. Obama, on the other hand, is saying, well, I want to save people, and that's why I'm doing it. Well, Putin is very confused because he thinks in a very strategic, very Russian way. Obama is thinking in a very emotive way of, I want to save these people that are at risk. And I don't blame him. I mean, the Islamic State is a nasty bunch of people. Putin's looking over at Ukraine and saying, the West is really upset because I'm trying to save Russian citizens while the West is bombing Syria when there's no Western... Well, two beheadings of American citizens?
Well, yeah.
So look at there's completely different scenarios, completely different reasons, but the similarity is enough there that Putin is very confused. And he's not sure what Obama's going to do in either way. He's looking at Syria and he's going, Obama's a smart guy. And then he's looking elsewhere and he's going, well, maybe, what is he,
actually,
I don't know what's going on here.
Actually, he clearly does not understand a few things.
He's very Russian-centric perspective.
Yeah, he clearly doesn't understand. See, he leads Russia and shapes public opinion, and it goes the direction he wants to go.
Right, he thinks really Obama does the same thing.
And he doesn't realize that public opinion shapes our president.
Right, our president is herded by the cats in Russia. The president herds the cats.
And there was a very good article in The Economist, which Lynn Willey says he doesn't read.
Well, he doesn't read as much, he said. Let's be
well,
exact.
Actually,
he said he doesn't read as much as you do.
Okay, well, I don't think I actually don't think he reads the magazine.
It could be. It could,
but anyway,
he probably read something of it.
Said, really fascinating, how to make 300 million enemies quickly. And it
there
showed
you
the issue that two Americans were publicly beheaded. Suddenly, he said it's something that in that particular part of the world they just don't understand. You publicly kill an American.
In a way that they have not earned.
You just publicly kill an American. And every American in the United States of America and outside the United States of America suddenly feels personally at risk.
Yeah.
And that it is absolutely incomprehensible to them that individuals mean that much to us. They just don't get it. If, for example, one fighter pilot were to bail out somewhere in Syria... and be running around hiding from ISIS, the fact that we would commit the entire armed forces of the United States to finding that one pilot, despite our promises, no boots on the ground.
Right, and we would do it.
It's just absolutely, it's incomprehensible to Vladimir.
Individual rights are something that we hold dearly. The Russians hold some form of aggression and patriotic spirit, where Islamic State holds an aggression and religious spirit.
Yeah, actually, I've often said the one way that ISIS could defeat itself totally is to shoot down an aircraft and have the pilot survive and be running around over there.
Yeah, that would do it.
And under those circumstances, the entire might of the United States Armed Forces would gradually be brought to bear to rescue that pilot.
And Russia wouldn't have a clue as to why it happened.
Neither would ISIS, by the way.
And when we're looking at, you know, I brought this question up several times over the past week. Why is it that Russia has not completely annexed Ukraine? And I've had the same reaction repeatedly. Well, we wouldn't let them. And I say, wait a minute. We let them take Crimea. That's part of Ukraine.
Right.
We let them take South Ossetia. That's part of Georgia. Why would we not let them? There's not something that, we're doing nothing. We've got no treaty that obligates us.
Right. And we've got a Secretary of State that very specifically has stated we will not get involved in the defense of Ukraine.
Right. The reason why Russia hasn't taken Ukraine is because he doesn't want to. Ukraine owes them a bunch of money, and it's much more likely that
they get to J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, we are. It's much more likely. This is great. There's a banking tariff. There's all these lockdowns of people, Russian politicians. There's lockdowns on their personal accounts. The owner of the gas company of Russia has been sanctioned. He can't get to his money. However, the European Union is offering to pay him billions of dollars if they turn on the gas to Ukraine. If Russia takes Ukraine, those billions of dollars aren't going to be available.
Well, they could take half of Ukraine.
Well, they kind of sort of have, actually. They're just not saying so much. They've got a big chunk of Ukraine with a bunch of Russian soldiers on it.
Recently, most of those soldiers, according to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, apparently most of the soldiers have left now.
Right. Well, they're still sitting on the other side of the border. There's a ceasefire going on.
Yep.
Now, the Russian rebels are fighting over the Donetsk airport right now, and it looks like there are Russian troops involved there. So they want to have one half of Russia or one half of Ukraine as a autonomous area that the Russian troops can move in and out of, but they don't want to take all of Ukraine because the European Union would then not pay the debt owed to Russia by Ukraine for their gas.
What you're trying to say,
huge amounts of money.
I understand. What you're trying to say is Vladimir Putin wants a peace agreement.
Yes, I want a piece of this and a piece of that and a piece of this over here. Yes, a peace agreement.
And by the way, folks, from my hawkish point of view, those of you who haven't studied the pre-World War II history, this is how Germany got rolling. They kept insisting that there were places in Europe,
German-speaking, German citizens,
German-speaking people in there, and had once been part of Greater Germany.
They were just going back to the way it used to be.
And they just needed to go and liberate those people and protect them until they invaded Poland. And the reason they invaded Poland, by the way, Russia invaded Poland at the same time. This is not in the history books. They both invaded Poland at the same time.
Yeah, Stalin said, well, I want that too. You can't have it all.
Fascinatingly enough, we did not declare war on Russia.
Interesting.
I say we. The Allies, the British and the French did not declare war on Russia, but they did on Germany. Now, there, you want a great irony. Russia and Germany invaded Poland at exactly the same moment. It was a coordinated attack.
And Germany had war declared on them.
And the Western European nations declared war on Germany, but not on Russia. And there's a very good reason they didn't declare war on Russia. They looked at the size of Russia and said, you got to be kidding.
We're not going to try to invade that place. That's a huge area.
And
it's cold over there.
Right. So the parallels between Germany taking, with minimal military effort, chunks of what's called the Sudetenland and Czechoslovakia and Austria.
All right. You get a free pass on that. That's fine. It used to be Germany. That's fine. You're good.
Yeah, it used to be part of the Austro-Hungarian-German Empire.
Right.
Anyway, so you're listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we've been discussing geopolitics here.
And encryption. Geopolitical encryption.
Right.
How's that?
And we are going to break for some commercials, though, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And that's if today is Saturday, October 4th. Otherwise, the telephone numbers have changed to protect the innocent.
Or guilty.
Something is the case.
Maybe. Somebody's been protected.
Now that you've said all of that, I would like to talk about some other things.
I think we should just sit here and be silent.
Well, we had some very good job gains. Reported.
Congratulations.
Would you close that?
Sure.
Okay. We had the unemployment rate is down to 5.9%, which is right at where the Federal, it's within the band that the Federal Reserve has said is normal and probably will be normal into the future. So we are actually coming back to something pretty close to normal unemployment rates at this point. So what we've got, the gain of 248,000 new jobs with people in them, and an upward vision to, that was September. July's got revised upward.
Did you say vision or revision?
We've got to
look at
revision.
Things. If it's been visioned, you can see it. If you revise it, you looked at it again.
Okay. Our average monthly employment gain in the United States for the first 9 months of the year now is 227,000, which is the best we've done since March of 2006. This is excellent. This is an indication that our economy continues to heal, continues to grow. Yes, there are definitely some what is referred to as inequities in the economy, where a lot of the lower income people, and I would say roughly half of the workers in the economy, have not seen actual pay increases. Rather, they have seen net pay decreases since the recession. Lynn was talking about the fact that he lost his salary and he's downhill. Those are almost uniformly in what is referred to in economics as tailing industries. In other words, tailing jobs. They're jobs that, very frankly, are likely to be replaced at some point with a computer.
Right.
And they are relatively low-skilled jobs. And the reason is, and Lynn...
Well, let's not say that Lynn's job is unskilled.
I'd say relatively.
Right. When he's talking, he's got to have his facts together. So let's not...
No.
We're talking about a general sense of tailing jobs, not Lynn Woolley's job.
Well, let's talk about Lynn Woolley's job for a moment.
Okay.
The problem with Lynn Woolley's job is it's a highly skilled job in a sector of the economy, specifically AM radio.
Right.
That he himself said a few minutes ago is going away.
Right.
The sticks are going away. The we're going to an internet radio system, not an AM radio system. There's a consolidation going on. In what happens is as technology and industries get older, and this is something that is just inevitable through history, consolidation goes on.
If you look at the... manufacturing of automobiles.
Right.
Starting in the early 1900s, we had hundreds, maybe thousands of automobile manufacturing
brands. That's
exactly
what I was going to give as an example.
Right.
And healthcare, yes, he said, he made the statement last hour, probably accurately. He was quoting the head of the Mayo Clinic as saying that there will eventually be about four major healthcare providers in the United States. Well, how many major automobile manufacturers are there in the United States?
Right.
Interestingly enough,
depends on what you label in the United States.
Right, and that's an interesting point because it's entirely possible we could get Japan healthcare system, Japanese or German healthcare systems, eventually moving into the United States and competing with American healthcare
system. When we're talking healthcare, let's approach this. I started to bring this up with Lynn as he was leaving. You're familiar with the supercomputer called Watson?
I am.
Watson has been leased to the medical community.
It's lost a tremendous amount of weight recently.
Watson has lost weight, yes, it has.
It's much smaller than it used to be.
It can fit on a much smaller area. And what they're finding is that diagnosis of heart conditions, diagnosis of a lot of things that doctors generally do and tend to get wrong before they get right when they do get it right sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Watson's a lot better at doing that, just like he was better at beating the great champions of Jeopardy, the people that we consider brilliant and geniuses. You know, Ken Jennings wrote how you're, you know, the genius series for your kids. We kind of collectively say this man is a very brilliant man. He must be a genius. Watson beat the snot out of him. I mean, walked him around the place as a, you know, it was like the Dallas Cowboys. You may think that they're a good team or a bad team when they show up at a little league baseball game. A baseball game.
Right.
And then play football with the baseball team. That's what Watson did to the Jeopardy champions.
Basically, I think a better analogy would be the best college team in the United States.
Right.
Probably couldn't hold a candle to the worst professional team in
Correct.
The United States.
Correct. And when we're talking about Watson, it was a bigger divide than that. And it's only that technology is only going to get better. And it's going to be very, you know, the X Prize right now, the prize, the $10 million prize that they give out for different things. The first one was the first commercial orbit, the first commercial into space.
Actually, two suborbitals. It was
right.
The first one. Yeah.
And so $10 million was given. Well, now they're giving the next X Prize is going to be, first, it's in water purification, and that's about to be awarded as soon as the FDA gives the thumbs up. The next one is basically a tricorder. It's the tricorder prize. It's the Star Trek.
I've got one ordered.
The Star Trek wave a wand over somebody and figure out what's wrong with them. And fit that into something like Watson, who's just learning more. It's not like they're going to be getting dumber in the future. We are going to have a tremendous drop in the price of medicine in general.
Right.
That concept is going to exist, and it's already starting. We're beginning to see it in that.
You and I agree on that, by the way, and Lynn Willey doesn't agree.
If you look at the cost, you know, a decade ago of the cocktail that was the drug cocktail that was given to HIV patients to keep them HIV positive but not AIDS, we looked at that price, and everybody in the United States said, man, that's expensive. That's a lot of money to pay for something, but it's keeping people alive, so we're going to pay for it. We're now shipping that cocktail off to Africa at extremely low cost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens over time. We get that research recovery money back, and the medicine price drops. Now, we talk about the price of medicine in the United States. Because we're researching new medicine constantly, and the old medicine's not good enough.
It was to support what you just said. You know, the Ebola patient, the Ebola victim, I guess we'll call him,
mm-hmm.
who
in Dallas,
who showed up. He showed up in the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor examined him,
sent him home,
and sent him home with some antibiotics. Now the point is, the doctor didn't look at the screen that included his recent travels.
Right.
It
Watson would have seen that.
And Watson would have seen that. And
Watson would have immediately given him the virus test.
There is a tremendous resistance in any professional area, particularly in medicine.
High-skilled professional area.
Toward allowing a computer to take over.
Yeah.
And
it was there in the airline industry when people were
Certainly.
Talking about autopilot. They were like, I don't trust it. It
right.
might turn off all of a sudden, you know. And
now when we have accidents, it's because they turn off the autopilot.
Why didn't you let the airplane land itself? Well, I didn't feel comfortable with it. Well, you crashed the airplane.
And so Lynn is concerned that the price of healthcare is going to go through the stratosphere.
It may go up before it goes down.
Well, it's leveled. And a lot of the leveling has to do with computers, and it has to do with the fact that we know physicians who are very upset that they don't get their bonuses the way they used to. And
right.
the reason they don't is because the price of health care is coming down. And very frankly, a tremendous amount of what they were previously doing is now capable of being done by computers.
Or by an assistant who doesn't need the same level of training
right.
because they have equipment that
And we don't like
things.
That.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's if you will, it's John Henry being replaced by a steam engine.
You got it. And matter of fact, that is precisely the analogy. It occurred about 100 years ago.
That was John Henry, wasn't it? Well, I guess 150 years ago.
Well, we're talking about 100 years ago. There was a major change in society where the automobile.
Right.
And the internal combustion engine was replacing the man behind the plow and the animals and the people who still, and it's hard to believe that 100 years ago in the United States, in the beginning of the 20th century, animals still provided as much transportation as internal combustion engines
right.
did.
Right, and the cost of food as a percentage of someone's income was about 35%. It's now closer to 6%
mm-hmm.
as a percentage of people's income.
And it's not that we're not going to need nurses. It's not that we're not going to need hospitals. But I will say that we are, any time that you get a major institution like that where the computer is quickly approaching the point of doing the job better.
It's called destabilization of an industry. It happens.
It's going to happen, and physicians are not going to be very happy about it. And
it's happened to banking. It's caused some consolidation in banking.
Some.
Quite a lot of consolidation
in
banking.
Yeah, too big to fail.
Right. And yes, there are banks that have lots of offices all over the place, but as we go more and more electronic with it, as people get paid directly to their bank account, it's a lot less important to have a bank right next to you. You know what the number one reason that there are so many bank branches are?
Why?
And there's a lot of studies on this. Because people tend to use the bank that's closest to their business.
Mm-hmm.
If when they're going home, they want to stop and drop off their check. Well, what if you don't have to stop and drop off your check anymore?
And I think we're going to see that. Let me throw a couple of things in. We're almost out of time for this, the second hour, on Saturday, October 4th, the personal wealth coach. A couple of things, a little longer term for those of you who are in the investing world, who are interested in this. Without exception, since World War II, following a midterm election, which we're about to have, for those of you who haven't noticed, in November, the year following the midterm election, the equity markets in the United States appreciate significantly. There's very few things I can say without exception about. Factually, you can go back to the beginning of the century, and it's true, but it isn't quite as obvious during the Depression, the Great Depression, but the probabilities are that a year from now, the stock market will be significantly higher than it is today. That doesn't mean that in the next few weeks we won't have a correction. There's a lot of generally when small cap stocks are in a correction level, and they are, they're down about 20%, the rest of the market will, in many cases, not in every case, will go ahead and follow suit just because they love small caps so much. But meanwhile, back at the ranch, a year from now, his history tells us there's an extremely high probability we will see significant gains with over the next 12 months. So that's something to kind of stick around in the back of your mind. The other thing is there's a couple of, I think, important economic points to make and as our last statement out. The world is now divided again into two areas, the rest of the world and the United States. The rest of the world, to some degree, is struggling. And by the way, the euro is at $1.25 right now. I well remember when it was $1.40. The euro is at the lowest level against the dollar that it has been in many, many years. I don't know, decades and decades. The same is true across the rest. Japan is trying to fight off a recession. Europe's trying to fight off a recession. We're thinking about raising interest rates because our economy is running so well. And that's something to bear in mind. The last deficit is down. The economy is doing well. Unemployment is down to a reasonable level. Yeah, we still got some problems left, but as Lynn Willie pointed out, we're very optimistic about the future. And that's the word from the personal wealth coach.
All right. If you would like to contact us off the air during the weekend, we have a voicemail waiting. During the week, there's a live person that actually answers the phone. If you have questions or something to inspire us to further conversation next week, locally, the voicemail number is
947-1111.
You can also reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com, as in thepersonalwealthcoach.com, or Jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to podcasts. You can read more about our philosophy and how we invest money. And that, basically, if you want to keep listening to Insanity, the podcasts are there for that. So
until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. We're running
10 seconds ahead. So we'll have 10 really seconds from now. You'll have to wait a week before you can hear us again.
Probably pretty accurate.
Until two weeks.
Because there's this.
This has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Barbaric concussion stuff.
It's not just a word on your box.